Congratulations!
You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Wazwaz.
We're out here on the sidewalk. Maysoon, I finally saw Coax show at Alter Space.
Oh, right. You were talking about that show last week.
You know, I don't think any of the things in that show were paintings.
What the hell were they then?
I think they were a lot of like
performances.
I think they were a lot of like pastel work, like
drawings.
Yeah,
cool.
But God, they look like paintings. And I gotta say, I love a lot of painters in the Bay Area, but I think Coax is right up there in my top three.
That is super exciting, Kate. I can't wait to see that show. I need to go during lunch, have a quick bike ride over there. Have a quick look.
It's not far. It's not far from your work.
Yeah.
There's also, so it's a lot of nudes, a lot of nude women, but their bodies are all distorted, a lot of like flattened appendages, and somebody's got a lightning bolt leg, in my opinion. Birds. The show's called Bathers.
Oh, I love it.
There's giant bars of soap with the letter B on them. You can buy the soap itself. A painting sitting on two enormous bars of soap.
It's like Chris Ofili.
Yeah.
And the sitting on the two pieces of elephant dung.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it.
She was in a bus at the first parking lot art fair, and she had all these drawings pinned up, and I swear she was selling them for super cheap.
And I was like, God damn it, why didn't I get one then?
Yeah, because the work in this show, and the show's almost sold out. I looked at the price
really?
List.
Oh, good for her.
And I was like, God, I want to own everything and just stare at it till I die.
That used to be Esta Noche. Now it's called Bond Bar.
Oh, we're over here almost at 16th and Valencia. And Bond Bar really sucks. I feel like that place attracts a lot of douchebags at night.
Barf bags. That's what I call them. I went to a dance concert last weekend. Kim Epifano's The Last Blue Couch. And it was about gentrification in the Soma neighborhood. It was The Last Blue Couch is referencing the public art project, I believe, by Brian Goggin, the defenestration project. Remember that? Where there were couches and chairs hanging out of this apartment building on like 6th and Mission. That got torn down and is now a housing building. But anyhow, the performance started at 7 in Soma, and it took place in like probably 7 different outdoor locations, and all the while they were like wheeling this blue couch through, so they were weaving these different stories of displacement, but actually pretty sort of hopeful or like really sort of lovely stories of people living in the neighborhood starting from like the early 1900s to today. It was sort of a really interesting storytelling for the day. But from 7 to 8 on the street, and then they had an actual performance at YBCA at like 9. So it was a very, very long, it's like a 3-hour occasion. It's really interesting.
Did you pee at all during the performance?
I did not.
Couldn't do 3 hours without going to the bathroom.
Well, I mean, once we got to YBCA at like 10:30, I went to the bathroom and everyone stood in line and got a snack. It was this weird situation where all of a sudden I was getting a ticket and I turned around and everyone had a bag of popcorn. And like, oh, they were handing it out. And like literally ran around the atrium of YBCA looking for the popcorn hander outer and couldn't fucking find them. And I was like, God damn it. So I ran my ass to Target and got some snacks at Target.
All right. So here's our interview with Scott Hewitt. We're out here in the beautiful Mission District of San Francisco, California, talking to artist, musician, educator, Scott Hewicker.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be here.
Could you talk a little bit about this building we're in? We're in a very unique studio space here.
Well, we are in the Redstone Building on 16th and Cap, and it was the former location and the historical location of the Labor Temple of San Francisco. It's a 100-year-old building, and basically it houses a lot of artists and left-wing activists and all sorts of organizations, nonprofits and theater groups and that kind of thing. And the lab, of course, the lab is in this building, and the wonderful lab.
Considering all the people that are sharing this space, the hallways, are surprisingly clean.
Yes. I think they just recently had some inspections, I think. And so, like, there used to be a lot of junk in the hallway, and then all of a sudden it was gone one day. I don't know what else to say about it.
How long have you been here?
21 years. So.
Shit.
Yeah. It's a long time for San Francisco. But I'm hidden away in the back corner, the last place with light. On the other side, they're going to have a building go up there, so a lot of people on that side are going to lose their light, which is really a bummer.
So you're also a painter.
Yes, I am. Yeah, so mostly this is all my work.
You're in the studio. There are many paintings.
Tons and tons of paintings. So anybody wants a painting, just come by and get it. Just take it out of me. Like, really, you're doing me a favor?
So are you painting exclusively in acrylics?
Exclusively in acrylic, yeah. So sometimes a little spray paint, but that's still acrylic as well. I teach a painting class that people do paint oil, and so I can teach oil, but I don't like oil myself.
Because of the toxins.
Toxins, yes.
So you teach painting. Are you teaching sort of what level of painting do you typically teach?
I have two sort of teaching jobs, and when I teach painting, I'm actually teaching it on my own private classes. I teach at a small school out in the Sunset. It's a private school called Jean Henry School of Art that's been around since the 60s. Might be Jean Henri, so who was this? Who I never met, but she was a French woman who taught Impressionist painting classes. But she had a big following here in the 60s. And she'd make her students buy her work.
And you also teach at CCA.
I teach at CCA in the first year program. I teach a class called 2D color translation, and it's a two-dimensional. Survey class using color to talk about sometimes different issues. There's like a conceptual part and a technical part to each assignment.
When I was in school, we had to do the Munsell color book. Do you know that?
Yes, I do know that. Yes, but that seems like it would be very difficult.
We felt like we had to, because it was like a little red book that came with the color chips and like a little binder, and you had to put the chips in so that they were like showing chromatic intensity and value. Right. And it felt like we all had the Communist Manifesto or something, like we were being indoctrinated.
So it's just the charts of each color.
And then we learned to chart that, and then we'd have to chart our colors from our 2D assignments in the same kind of graph.
I'm always fascinated. I always wanted to, like, does anybody make them do the model? Like, because the model of it is so weird. It's like not a sphere. It's not a chart. It's like this weird clustery thing that, the reds go out way, and the yellows are only this much and the reds are out way deep.
Yes. And there were teachers at my school who had a lot of, like, they'd get into it where they're like, I don't believe that red and blue are like intrinsically different tone values.
Yeah, I know. I start to bring that in, and then I lose my students immediately. They're like, I say at the beginning of my class, I'm like, just remember three things. If you only remember these three things, you'll be good. Hue, value, saturation. Like, and just now, and then at the end of the class, I'm like, so what are the three things? They're like, value. They're just like, they still don't, like, I mean, it's really hard to get students to remember.
Can we talk about value? What's the difference between value and saturation? Sorry, I just took my very first basic drawing class, and so all this stuff is like so fascinating to me. Yeah.
You guys probably didn't have hue and saturation because you weren't working in color.
I feel like, isn't that when something's going from light to dark?
Yes.
So I think of that as also a form of saturation to some degree.
Saturation is about vibrancy and dullness. So like the intensity of a color and then the dullness, mutedness of a color. So when it's mixed, you can have something that's light but not bright, something that's bright but not light. So those are different things. Those are different measuring factors.
On hue?
Well, hue is basically the way we... we border the colors. So what we know is the red hue family, and so basically as it goes from red to the borders of red, orange, and yellow, orange, and I'm not looking at a color.
That was a thing too.
Yeah. But it denotes temperature. It denotes, so it describes, what's warm and cool as well. So hue, I put temperature and hue together. as another kind of measurement. So there's like these three measurements that, you know, sort of describe color, the properties of color. So, is it warm? Is it cool? Is it muted? Is it vibrant? Or is it light or dark and stuff? And all these things are relative to each other. So they're not, when you look at one color, it's just its own color. But you don't know, you can't describe its value, hue, or, I mean, you could describe its hue properly, but its value or saturation you can't really describe unless you put it in relationship with another next to something else, yes. So,
do you want to talk a little bit about the content of your work?
The content of my work?
Or be just other than how it's made. What is it?
I don't know. It takes on many forms, I guess. I really go a lot on suggestion. I used to paint a lot of landscapes. I think landscape was my way into painting after art school. And I didn't really know how to paint representationally, but landscape seemed like a way that was like I could make a simple environment. And then I started building up from there and started making these kind of psychedelic things for a while. These kind of really fantastical, logic-defying landscapes that had a very kind of utopian or dystopian kind of feel to them. Something was always on the edge of, like, change. But then after I graduated from Stanford in 2005, I kind of found myself a little, I don't want to say floundering, but I was, like, bored of what I was doing and I wanted to change. And so I've been just kind of teaching myself how to paint again, I guess, in a way, you know, for the last few years. And, you know, like teaching these beginning painting classes, I was like, I never did still life in my undergrad. Like, I never did all that stuff that you were like, oh, beginning painting class. Like, I never did that. I was like, oh, convention, boring. And, you know, I remember like my first painting class and I'm just all like, pouring paint and then mixing it all around and just seeing what happens and having, you know, I don't know. It was just all really, it was a mess. It was a hot mess. But then now I'm like, oh, still life. Actually, wow. You know, I don't know, kind of going back to it in a way, looking, you know, finding kind of these interesting things in sort of genre painting, portraits and still lives. And so I do that a little bit. And then I do these abstract paintings that are, I don't know, based on phone numbers. I got like a stack of these canvas board paintings. I was doing patterns and stuff from like mosaics that were all borrowed from Chapel of the Chimes. Oh. It's really into like the weird death cubicle thing, you know, like here's my life, you know, like put away in this kind of vessel for eternity, and the like stained glass and that kind of dynamic. And I don't know, I don't know what, you know, I don't have a style. I feel like I don't have a style. So, and I think that maybe that's not been a good thing for me over the years, but
like career-wise, or
yeah, I guess so. It's just, you know, it's a little all over the place. I always felt like that was always the weird thing in San Francisco, that everybody kind of like they landed on their style, like the thing that did it, you know, that was very successful, and they just kept going with that and pushing that thing and stuff, and then I just never really got there with it. I was always just like, okay, I want to try something else. Try something, you know. I just feel like I'm always starting again at the beginning. And I always like that place, too. And I mean, that's maybe why I teach beginning classes a lot, just because I like kind of that, like, okay, what is next? Oh, you know, geez, blank canvas again. What do I do? Like, you know, and then it's always like, what's around me? You know, what's feeding me? And it's always something very kind of weird and random. Like my phone numbers were like was like a thing I was doing, where I was just doing like paint outs of, you know, like doing these abstract paintings, but then I'm like, well, these abstract paintings are kind of cool, but they're like, I don't know, abstraction also was a weird thing for me. It's like, mm-hmm. I like it, I appreciate abstraction, but it's like, is it enough? Is it done? Is it like, I don't, you know, there's things I like about it, but at the same time I'm always like confused by it as well. I'm never really settled with it. You know, I'm like, I could keep working on this forever. Does it, you know, does it need another thing? I would make these abstract paintings and then negatively paint the negative space around and create these phone numbers. So like the phone number were the, like were the abstraction.
I'm like, keep going. Keep going.
And so it was like going through all my phone numbers in the past, like, you know, the, my very first phone number, and then my, you know, the phone number that me and Cliff shared when we first moved in, and then the phone number we had when we were, because we just had, we had a landline until like, you know, a year and a half ago. I always wish I had like a thing to say, like, my painting's really about this, and, you know, and it's all about the quietude of blah, 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 you know, or whatever, and like, you know, like, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, like, I can never compartmentalize, like, you know, when everybody talks, like, so what's your paintings about? And I'm like, okay, here we go. you know, and you would think it would be easier after, like, 20-something years, 27 years of, you know, dabbling, but it's not. I don't know how to talk about it any more than I did when I was in art school, you know, just like my first painting class. So I always thought it was about one thing, but it's never really about one thing, and it's never about a formula of things. So it's always kind of, but it's not about everything either, or whatever you want it to be. So this, it's like that weird thing about it, like, okay, well, you know, it's not whatever you want, and it's not like, you know, whimsical dreamscapes, which was what I got, you know, my first Sika visit, where it was like, oh, that's when I stopped doing landscape painting. I was like, oh, I love these whimsical dreamscapes. And I was like, oh, you just killed it. You just killed it. For me, I don't know. It's just like, that's really what you get from it. Okay. I don't know. But I get into like weird esoteric theories of like, you know, kind of culty things, like the
go on
the Theosophists, Annie Besant, C.W. Leadbeater.
Who are they?
They wrote this book called Thought Forms in 1901, and they were like kind of these clairvoyants, or supposedly clairvoyants, and they made these paintings that were manifestations of these complex emotions. And they're sort of not the very first abstractions, but they have like this weird abstract quality to them. They're very much like painter Hilma af Klimt, who's, you know, now retroactively being considered the, you know, the inventor of abstract painting, even though it's not quite right. I mean, she was definitely an early painter, and in before like Kandinsky and a lot of like those painters, but I don't think she was considering herself as part of like the milieu of like art world 1901. But these were spiritual thinkers that were using abstract imagery to sort of convey the spiritual world of, you know, of numerical systems, geometric, organic systems together.
Did they commune with the dead?
They did. Hilma af Klimt was a spiritualist. Same with Emma Kunz, who was also, she did these automatic drawings. And so they believed that they were communing with spirits.
Do you do that?
No, I don't. I'm a bit of a, not a skeptic necessarily, but I have a weird distance with, like, I have an attraction and a distance with the whole thing, because I grew up very religious, and I still have this sort of hang up about things, and in some level. And so I get, you know, I don't know. I think of it as consciousness more than like the spiritual world necessarily. I mean, I think those things are maybe they coincide together, and maybe there's like more like a Jungian collective conscious kind of thing. But I don't commune with the dead because I get nervous about that, you know. I still have fears of going to hell, you know, that kind of thing. You know, weird little, like, stuff that I, like, oh, I'm over it, but I still, like, am I over it? I don't know. You know, that kind of thing. That stuff, like, that hits you really deep as a kid when it's like...
Were you raised Catholic?
No, I wasn't. And my family is Presbyterian, and my family actually is not very religious at all. And when I say I grew up religious, they sent me to a religious private school after my two older brothers sort of didn't do well in the public school system. And so my parents didn't want me to follow that same path. So they sent me to a religious school. And even though my parents are very, you know, they very, you know, much believe in God and all this stuff, they, you know, we don't go to church, they didn't baptize me, anything like that. But man, I heard from it like at school. You know, like, oh, your parents didn't baptize you? Well, you know what they say about that. And all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, it's just like, oh, your parents don't go to church. I see. You know, well, there's problems with that. And, you know, and then, you know, but, and I was isolated from my, you know, like family, you know, it's weird. Like I was like, had this religious environment that I wasn't really sharing with my family. It was part of my growing up, but at the same time, I was like really separate experience from like what my family was, you know, influencing me on. And so that created a rift, you know, psychologically with me. And so...
Is your family still Presbyterian?
Yes, they are. I mean, they don't practice, though. And it's weird, though. It's like, you know, the whole gay marriage thing was like, you know, when the vote came up in California, and I was calling my mom and my dad, and I was like, look, I know, you know, this is not your issue, maybe, but, you know, you usually vote thinking, you know, you don't really consider it. You know, it's all about your, you know, your, they're Republicans. It's all about your immediate environment. And now, like, you know somebody this is going to affect. And I want to encourage you. Hopefully you'll vote the right way. And they're like, well, I was brought up to believe stuff in a certain way. And I'm like, really? Really? You're going to bring that up now? Like, you know, we never went to church. We only went to church on Christmas Eve occasionally. Like, you know, it didn't matter. We're married. It worked out in our favor. So, you know, like, even though, like, we were, like, for the longest time, like, not even for, like, we were, like, not going to get married. Yeah. We were together so long. Me and Cliff, like, we were like, you know, marriage is just going to jinx it, right? You know?
Yeah, when you're with someone for so long, you start to wonder, like, what would happen if we actually got married? Is this a bad idea? Yeah. Yes.
I know. I mean, and there's always some story, maybe it's an urban legend or something, like, oh, this couple, like, our friends, like, you know, we're together 25 years, and then they got married, and then a year later, it was over, you know, and you're like, that's gonna happen to us, Cliff. It's, you know, yeah, it hasn't happened to us.
Good.
Yeah.
I don't think
it will.
Where did you grow up again?
Orange County, Irvine. I grew up in Irvine, California.
So you and Cliff published a book. Is it Good Times, Bad Trips?
Yes.
Artists telling stories of their, like, drawing, illustrating, and telling stories of their actual bad trips, or
on LSD
or any kind. Actually, it was very open in terms of what the bad trip was. So sometimes it's bad travel experiences. Yeah. You know,
I love it.
Yeah.
I want this to be a podcast.
Oh,
seriously, can you and Cliff do a podcast?
Oh yeah,
we could. Well, the book we got offered a show at Gallery 16. We had shown there in the 90s. We showed there like once every 10 years. We go way back with Gallery 16, but it's funny. We're not like a stable artist with them. And Griff doesn't care. Like, he'll just like, oh, you're one of our oldest artists or whatever. But he doesn't care, or like, if we show elsewhere or who else we show with or whatever we do. He's just really, he's always been very cool with it. And so he's like, oh, well, it's about time you have another show, like 10 years after our first show. And then we always show together there, or we have. And Cliff has had one solo show separate from me. So I was like, well, they're doing all these artist books. Like, we should do one too. And so, but we didn't know how what the organizing principle would be. Like, I feel like every time me and Cliff show, this is a weird perception about me and Cliff. I think a lot of people think we're like partner artists or like collaborative artists.
Right.
And we're not. And people then go like, I don't know who did what. And, you know, and except for like people who are closest to us know, like, I paint on stretch canvas, Cliff paints on paper, mm-hmm. Cliff's are text based, my more image or abstract based. And usually most people can tell the difference, but there's a lot of people like Alan Bamberger, for one.
Pinky Cam.
Who can never tell. You know, like, oh, I don't know. And like, he never reads the things. I don't know what it is. Anyway, there's always wrong attributions on our business site. So about who did what. We proposed this book to Griff at Gallery 16. We were like, well, we have all these really interesting painting, you know, we did all the artwork. So all the artwork was us. So, but we need an organizing principle. So we want to ask our friends to see if they'll record these stories, and then we'll print up a story and try to match it up with one of our images of some kind. And, you know, and so he thought, you know, he wasn't sure about it, but he was like, okay, you know, he always has this, Griff is really funny because he'll always start off being like negative, like, oh God, I don't know. And he'll find a way to like, okay, it's going to be so hard. It's going to be really expensive. It's going to be a lot of work and everything and stuff. So, well, I just don't know. Well, why don't you come next week? We'll start working on it. And then, you know, like, you know, it's just like this thing where he has to go through this thing to like convince himself that, okay, you know, let's just do it. We solicited tons of our friends, and we didn't, also a lot of people didn't want their names associated with it. But I was like, nope. Nope. Some of your names are selling points, like, you know, yeah, Devendra Banhart, you know, people from Matmos, like, you know, we resolved it by putting everybody's name on the back and in the order of their writing, but their name wasn't attributed to their page. So, so that way, that way that people could,
you could really figure it out.
You could figure it out if you wanted to, but then it wasn't like, oh, this is Jack's story. I can tell, you know, like whatever, you know, it's just, you know, because the stories are all told in first person, and we kind of edit them in a way to kind of make them a little more conversational.
Have you done a lot of LSD?
I had done it a few times, like maybe 3 or 4 times by the time of the book, and I haven't done it since. But I've done like mushrooms a lot. My bad trip was the one that was in Portland with on a spring break. I used to go to school up in Portland. Oregon. My roommate's parents are very liberal parents, and they were recently married, my roommate's stepdad and mom, and turned out that they had some leftover acid from my ex-boyfriend, gave them as a, you know, it's a long story, but gave them as a wedding gift. And so they're like, oh, we still have some of this if you guys want to take it. And so it was with my roommate and his girlfriend and then my friend Jill. So we were all 4 in this weird condo complex in Portland, like outside of Portland, like in the suburbs. Oh, no. We decided, oh, why not? We're bored.
Nothing else to do.
Nothing else to do. So we took it. And within like 40, 50 minutes... it came really quickly apparent that only me and my roommate Tyler were feeling it, and the 2 girls did not feel anything. So part of it was bunk and part of it was still good. And so that was also like, oh great. So like, aww. So there's like 2 of us out of the 4 experiencing stuff. And then, so they were like, okay, we're bored. And they went back in to the condo, watched TV while me and Tyler like went walking around exploring. But then we ended up in this weird field. It rained and we were getting sopping wet. I stepped into a puddle and I had mud and all over my jeans. And then we're like, oh, fuck, this is terrible. So let's go back to the condo. And then we couldn't find the condo because they all looked the same. They all looked the same. So we're like wandering around and back and forth in circles just around this weird condo complex trying to figure it out. For like, it seemed like hours. It was really cold and like wet and muddy. And then, so then I went into, we finally found the house. We went inside and then it was like, you know, they had cats. So 2 cats, allergies. And so my allergies were acting out. And so I was all really sniffy. I was really sniffly all of a sudden. And then Tyler's stepdad was all like, kind of like making fun of me a little bit. Like, kind of like, oh, like, you know, you're all sniffy, or, you know, like kind of being, you know, just joking around. But at the same time, like, I'm the only one tripping. And, you know, and this is the time you're like, you're kind of like, I don't know you. And you're like, you're making me feel uncomfortable. I mean, we're in this small apartment. And then we decided to watch Kickboxer. You know, the Jean-Claude Van Damme film came on. And I don't know if you've ever seen this movie. But man, it's like not a movie to watch on acid. Really, it's like, it is so weird. What? It's just about like this weird underground fighting scene in some country, like the Philippines or something. And there's like this kind of monstrous kickboxer guy who's a villain. And he has like no face. Like literally, he had no face. Like he had this like weird, like sucked in face. And he's huge and he's like, you know, sparring against like these concrete poles. He's like, you know, this really badass guy. And then Jean-Claude Van Damme's like doing these weird dances. And like, you know, like there's this like scene where like, you know, he's training and then like his trainer gives him this kind of drug. And like, you know, so like to like, you know, I don't know. It was so bizarre. It was like give him this drug and like fight people in this bar, but he's also like dancing to the song. He doesn't realize he's fighting people. What is going on here? And, you know, finally, like, you know, after watching this movie, like seemed like it went on 8 hours. It was just like, oh my God, this movie is like, it's like the, it's telling the story of the universe. Something. I don't know what's going on. It's not like terrible. I think that, I think, you know, it's one of those books. It's a great, like, we call it a great bathroom book. Like, you get 5 minutes, you know, read a story.
Awesome. Do you have tips for artists that are in relationships with other artists?
I don't know. I think Cliff and I's situation really is unusual in some ways. And the fact that we have kind of a very big mutual respect for each other. And I've noticed artists who are in relationships with other artists have a little struggle with competitiveness and jealousy a little bit. I'm not naming names. I mean, I think also maybe, you know, me and Cliff have kind of kept at the same level over the years too. You know, it's not like we're like all of a sudden showing at the Guggenheim and, or one of us is showing at the Guggenheim and then, you know, or something like that, you know, and then the other, you know, but we're always, I mean, we're very supportive of each other. I think giving each other space, but also really acknowledging each other's influence. And
it's, and you both seem like pretty even keel. Mellow.
I am. No, I mean, Cliff can be, and you know, but you know, Cliff's a Leo, so, and I'm an Aquarius, so I think that's where we go. We get, you know, we're compatible that way, but yeah, like, you know, he's a very strong, strong personality in a lot of ways, a lot stronger than me. And so, you know, so, like, you know, in that sense, I'm more of a backseat kind of person to, you know, that's where I think our yin yang kind of works out, where I'm a little bit more introverted and he's a little more extroverted. My advice is just to be good to each other.
Is there anything else you would like listeners to know?
I think originally you guys, I think we were going to talk about Kiki at some point or in a different light. But, yeah. And so I was all like bringing, right. I was getting ready to bring all that stuff up, but we didn't touch that. And that's okay. That's okay. But I was thinking back, you know, but having to do that talk about the show in the 90s and talking about kind of the kind of queer mission scene in the early 90s that was really kind of potent. And that was happening at a time where, you know, it was just, I mean, Clinton just got elected. So, but there was still a lot of shit going on in politics and in the city and AIDS and the economy. And there was still this vibrancy and people were creating stuff out of nothing. And, but with this kind of great, amazing sense of beauty, humor, outrage, you know, and sadness to it. And I feel like we're revisiting that time again in a lot of ways. And I want to see that urgency come back into art. And I'm not sure if we're there yet. I think there's some great things going on. And I'm not one to speak for that because I'm such a hermit. I don't go out to much, and I know there's been a lot of things like with Southern Exposure doing some really great stuff about these issues, but I think that we need to get out and make work that's really visible again and not be in the galleries and not being just in our art world bubble, but like really talking to people and getting people involved. And it's easy to say that, and because, you know, I don't, you know, it's not like I'm doing those things myself, and I really would love to be that person to do it, but I want to see that again. It kind of reminded me of this great time, just going, looking back, you know, at the 90s and especially the Kiki Gallery, and the exhibit In a Different Light. I just feel like we're having that moment again. And I'm hoping that's all I want. I want people to be brave and make work and don't think of work as being superfluous in this time, you know, but make yourself your own artwork and be present.
Crying.
Aw, Mamie! Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today and letting us come into your awesome studio.
You guys are amazing. This was so fun.
And as always, congratulations.
Pine tree? What am I supposed to say there?
I love it.
If anybody has any comments, questions, or concerns, we're going to be locking up Maysoon's bike right now. But you can give us a call, 419-351-6606, or you can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast, or you could send us an email, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com. Don't forget we've got a website. I don't know if anybody's looking at that. congratulationspinetree.com. And until next week, from the bridge
to the other bridge,
to the island in between, this has been
Congratulations Pine Tree.